Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, Lebanon's foreign minister pleads for a ceasefire deal between Israel and Hezbollah in an address to the United Nations. Also, Japan about to get a new prime minister, and young scientists learning how to explain complicated ideas in plain English.
I'm used to speaking to a room full of scientists and nerds in the field, then standing in front of an audience without overloading them with scientific terms. It's challenging, but it's very rewarding in the end.
First tonight, to the latest on the conflict in the Middle East. Lebanon's foreign minister has given an impassioned speech at the UN in New York, calling for a ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah to prevent the situation spiralling out of control. A group of nations led by the United States and including France, Canada and Australia is proposing a three-week truce. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says his teams have been meeting with representatives of Lebanon to discuss the ceasefire, but he's vowing to continue striking Hezbollah targets with full force. This report prepared by Luke Radford.
In the Middle East, the battle echoes over the landscape as Israel targets Hezbollah on Lebanese territory. But in another faraway part of the world, a battle of words is taking place. Lebanese Foreign Minister Abdallah Bouhabib calling on the United Nations to force Israel to come to the negotiating table.
Lebanon is living through a crisis that threatens its very existence. The future of our people and our prosperity are in peril, and this is a situation that requires international intervention on an urgent basis before the situation spirals out of control with a domino effect, making this crisis impossible to contain.
The Foreign Minister did not hold back when giving his assessment of what might happen if the war continues.
It will be impossible to extinguish the flames of this crisis, which will transform into a black hole that will engulf regional, international peace and security. The crisis in Lebanon threatens the entire Middle East if the situation remains as it currently is.
And he made it abundantly clear what he believes is the cause of the violence.
What we are currently experiencing in Lebanon is a consequence of the failure to reach a lasting and sustainable solution for the Palestinians. The cause of this is the occupation, and we wish to reiterate this explicitly. The cause is the occupation.
Whether Israel decides to heed the calls is still up in the air. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says his teams have been meeting with representatives of Lebanon to discuss the ceasefire deal. But he also said this upon his arrival in the US.
My policy, our policy, is clear. We are continuing to hit Hezbollah with full force and we will not stop until we achieve all our goals. First and foremost, returning the residents of the north safely to their homes.
Mr. Netanyahu is due to give a speech at the UN General Assembly tonight, Australian time, in which he's expected to make his intentions clearer. Hezbollah has yet to respond to the calls for a ceasefire, but it has previously indicated it would depend on a separate ceasefire in Gaza. Meanwhile, hospitals in Lebanon's south are being overwhelmed by an influx of patients injured by Israeli airstrikes. This surgeon says his colleagues are being pushed to their limit.
Sadly, throughout this week, since Tuesday until today, the number of injured people and the types of injuries we've seen, that the whole world has seen, is truly terrifying. The medical staff and nursing staff are overwhelmed.
The death toll from Israel's airstrikes in Lebanon over the past week is more than 600. And in Gaza, the death toll continues to rise, with 41,000 fatalities in just over a year, according to Gaza-based health authorities.
Luke Radford reporting. For more on the proposed ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah, I spoke to Dr. Eyal Maroz, a senior lecturer in peace and conflict studies at Sydney Uni. Dr. Maroz, Israel is under huge pressure from other countries to accept this ceasefire, including from its biggest ally, the United States. Why do you think it's refusing to agree to it at this stage?
I think there are a lot of challenges and a lot of factors that the Israeli government and mainly Netanyahu in this case are juggling. Obviously, among the international community, It's really the Americans that hold the strongest leverage, if you like. And they seem to be refusing to go all the way. The upcoming elections are making it difficult for them to take a stronger stance, I think. That's a key reason. Another is the idea that Hezbollah, unlike what had happened on 7th of October in the border with Lebanon, it is the Hezbollah that has been attacking Israel. So if you like, the legitimacy for an Israeli retaliation is there much stronger than it is in the south in Gaza. But also Netanyahu is still shackled, if you like, by the radical elements in his government, and most cabinet ministers, not just these radical elements, are against de-escalation in the north. They think that such a ceasefire of 3 weeks as suggested will not make any contribution to the ultimate goal, which is enough of a pressure on Hezbollah to withdraw from the south and to allow more than 60,000 Israelis that left their homes a year ago to come back.
When you say the Americans aren't pushing hard enough or they're not going all the way, what do you mean? What else could they be doing?
Well, the Americans are, first of all, saying that they will protect Israel in case of an escalation, especially with Iran, but even with Hezbollah. So that provides Israel, the incentive or the calculation that they can risk, and I'm saying risk because neither side really wants an all-out war, but risk going just below the threshold of an all-out war, knowing or thinking that the Americans will be there for them.
Hezbollah, as I understand it, hasn't responded to the ceasefire deal at all. What do you think its tactics are?
We're getting a lot of mixed information from so-called senior diplomatic sources, and then at least one of them said that Hezbollah initially did sound positive about the option of a three-week ceasefire, but indeed we did not get any confirmation on that. Hezbollah is still, again, beholden and got himself into a bind by 11 months ago, tying the daily attacks on the north of Israel to a ceasefire in Gaza, and that is still the case. Should the Hezbollah now back down, that will be a sign of weakness and kind of loss of face, which in the Middle East is a big thing.
Do you think Hezbollah would only agree to a ceasefire if a ceasefire in Gaza were granted as well, given Hamas in Gaza is Hezbollah's ally?
Well, there's two contradicting factors here. Netanyahu, on his part, is trying to disengage the question of Gaza with the question of the north and Hezbollah, trying to get Hezbollah to withdraw without any ceasefire in Gaza. But the Americans on the other side are trying to link both in the hope that with Hezbollah agreeing to some kind of ceasefire, that will also encourage Hamas to agree to one in the south, or to agree to concessions that will lead to one in the south. I don't see that as a big, powerful incentive at the moment for either side. I think Hezbollah needs some kind of, if you like, a ladder to come down from the tree that it climbed up on, and think the diplomatic efforts will continue to look for one.
Benjamin Netanyahu says Israel is speaking to representatives of Lebanon about this proposed ceasefire. What role does Lebanon play in these negotiations, given that Hezbollah is an Iran-backed militant group operating in Lebanon?
I think the Lebanese government has been for the last 3 years a transitional one. The government as well as the Lebanese army have very little power. Hezbollah is the strongest force and power in Lebanon. So obviously Lebanon as a sovereign state has a much more, if you like, clout as well as relationship with the international community in terms of, if you like, mobilizing the international community, France, the US. But in terms of facing Hezbollah and instructing Hezbollah what to do or what not to do, I think their power is quite limited.
Dr. Eyal Moroz is a senior lecturer in peace and conflict studies at Sydney University. Japan is set for a new prime minister after the ruling party held a vote to decide who'll be its next leader. Shigeru Ishiba was voted in by his Liberal Democratic Party colleagues. The change at the top was triggered by the current PM, Fumio Kishida, announcing he was stepping down after prolonged periods of bad polling and a political donation scandal involving senior members of the party. James Ocean is the ABC's North Asia correspondent in Tokyo.
Well, the new prime minister will be Shigeru Ishiba. Now, he's a bit of a maverick from the regional part of Japan, the kind of part of Japan many tourists wouldn't visit, a part of Japan that's often forgotten and is suffering from population decline. But what has made him so popular, particularly among the voters, is, as I mentioned, he's a bit of a maverick. He's quite free at speaking his mind. When he does plenty of interviews with the media, he's quite open about his own personal views about how things should be done. And that has also meant that he's spoken out against the party in the past on many occasions. Now, he's a former defence minister and he's wanted this job of prime minister for a very long time. But the fact he's spoken out against the party so often in the past is the very thing that's hurt him. But in this time, it seems that the politicians in parliament have decided, look, he's probably the better option that we should pick. So in this case, it's not hurt him enough. So he has gotten over the line and he will become the next prime minister. Now, what we know about him, well, he's a bit more of a moderate on the side of the Liberal Democratic Party, a centre-right political party that's ruled Japan for almost the past 70 years with very few years in opposition. He has spoken out about helping all of Japan, not just the big cities. Japan's going through some tough economic times. And as I mentioned, there's parts of Japan suffering from severe depopulation. He's also a bit of a kind of seen as a bit of a policy expert. He likes to talk about needing a disaster minister in cabinet. He likes to talk about defence policy. And these are things that have really make him seem as a bit of a safe pair of hands, a status quo type politician. So don't expect any major shifts with him as we've seen under the current Prime Minister Fumio Kishida.
And James, who did he defeat in this vote for the top job?
Yeah, who he defeated is almost as interesting as the person himself. He beat Sanae Takaichi. Now, she, if she won, would have been Japan's first female prime minister. This is still a country where men absolutely dominate the senior positions of parliament and absolutely dominate the senior positions in business. Now, that might have seen as quite a progressive step had Japan, had the LDP, the Liberal Democratic Party, appointed her. But the caveat on that is that she is very conservative. In fact, it might have been too conservative for the party to appoint as their leader. She regards Margaret Thatcher as a hero. She's against same-sex marriage. Japan still does not allow same-sex marriage. But I think what would have ruffled a few feathers, which is putting it lightly, is that she was a big believer in visiting the Yasukuni Shrine, which honours Japan's war dead, including war criminals. Now, for a prime minister to visit that shrine would have caused absolute turmoil with an uproar in China and South Korea. And that last country is more important in that the United States has worked so hard to get Japan and South Korea to get along and get over their grief and their historical differences. So that would have really taken this effort back many steps had she become the Prime Minister.
James Oten is the ABC's correspondent in North Asia. He was speaking to me from Tokyo. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. Ahead, Melbourne gearing up for the first AFL Grand Final involving teams from New South Wales and Queensland. Global leaders will aim to reduce deaths associated with antibiotic-resistant infections by 10% in the next 15 years. They've been discussing the global health threat of antimicrobial resistance at the United Nations in New York this week. Their plan comes as new research indicates there'll be an estimated 40 million deaths associated with antibiotic resistance bugs by 2050. Catherine Gregory has more.
Imagine if you had an ear infection, urinary tract infection, or an infectious rash, and the antibiotic that used to make it disappear no longer works. Well, that could be the future for many of us.
There's a lot of conditions and antibiotics that are now increasingly having resistance to them.
Dr. Nicole Higgins is the president of the Royal Australian College of General Physicians.
So there are some common skin infections. There's something called MRSA, which is a staph infection that doesn't respond to our normal types of antibiotics. There are other types of infections such as bowel infections and also some sexually sexually transmitted infections as well that are becoming resistant.
Overseas, fatal infections like TB are also becoming resistant to antibiotics. And this challenge, known as antimicrobial resistance, is only going to get worse.
So antimicrobial resistance is probably one of the greatest threats to public health.
A study published in The Lancet this week found that more than 39 million people around the world could die from antibiotic-resistant infections in the next 25 years. But in the past day, leaders from the World Health Organization and the United Nations Environment Program had a high-level UN meeting in New York on this challenge. They set clear targets to reduce these predicted deaths by 10% by 2030.
But the response also has to come from many sectors in a well-coordinated manner.
Dr. Jean-Pierre Namazi is from the World Health Organization and was one of the leaders involved in the meeting. He says most leaders have developed action plans, but there are hurdles.
But when you go in terms of assessing how many have been implemented, there are very few because of lack of financing, and especially in the low and middle-income countries.
The plans include a target where at least 70% of antibiotics prescribed must belong to a WHO-approved list that ensures minimal side effects and lower potential to cause antimicrobial resistance, or AMR. There are also targets for better sanitation and infection control in low-income countries, as well as reducing the use of antimicrobials in agriculture and the general environment. So what has got us to this point? Is it simply that we're overusing antibiotics? Dr. Aaron Elborn from RMIT is a specialist in antimicrobial treatments and diagnostics.
One is the overuse and overprescription of antibiotics. Often it's not a bacterial infection that they've actually got. It's a virus or some other sort of illness like that. And the antibiotics are essentially doing nothing. All they're doing is entering the population and then building up more resistance. The other big issue and the other prong that we're having where we don't have that many new classes of antibiotics coming through the pipeline.
He says we need stricter guidelines on antibiotic prescribing to ensure it only happens for bacterial infections and education so that patients know they have to take the entire course of antibiotics.
That report from Catherine Gregory. The women fighting to exclude men from a lounge at Hobart's Mona Museum have had a legal victory today. A Supreme Court judge has ruled the so-called ladies' lounge can lawfully refuse to admit men. It's being hailed as an important decision for anti-discrimination law, but the case isn't quite over yet. Alexandra Humphreys filed this report.
A troop of women dressed in navy business attire perform a celebratory dance on the steps of Hobart's Supreme Court.
And we'll take a little strut.
Minutes earlier, they were handed a victory inside the courtroom in an anti-discrimination case brought against Mona Museum's exclusive ladies' lounge.
The verdict demonstrates a simple truth. Women are better than men.
Ladies Lounge founder Kersha Keshela is triumphant after the Supreme Court quashed an earlier tribunal ruling that would have forced the museum to open the lounge to men.
I'm very inspired by the occurrences in the courtroom today. In 30 seconds, the patriarchy was smashed.
Mona, which stands for Museum of Old and New Art, is on Hobart's outskirts and is openly very different from other art galleries with its eclectic collection and laid-back atmosphere. Its ladies' lounge was set up as an area where only women and girls could view certain works of art. Earlier this year, a New South Wales man brought the anti-discrimination case against Mona after he was denied entry to the ladies' lounge. He initially won the case before Mona appealed. Today, a judge has determined the lounge can lawfully exclude men because it was designed to promote equal opportunity for women generally. It's not necessarily the end of the matter, but for now, it's a win.
We are so thrilled. We're so excited. We're so thrilled. It feels wonderful.
The question of whether it's okay for a lounge to exclude men has sparked debate. Dr. Robin Banks is a former Tasmanian Anti-Discrimination Commissioner and is now a research fellow at the University of Tasmania. She believes the judge has made the right call.
It's important not just for Tasmania, but for Australia more broadly in terms of the idea that sometimes measures can be taken that indeed flip things on their head, that provide for a new way of promoting equality of opportunity. It's the sense of for women of experiencing a privilege, I guess, is the way of thinking of it. But it also flips it in the sense that it says to men, there are some things that you are not privileged in.
Catherine Lumby is a professor of media studies at the University of Sydney. She believes Kersha Keshela will be pleased with the way the entire saga has played out.
Her point was to draw attention to women's historic exclusion from power and forums of power. And she's made that point in a very witty and eloquent way.
Joanna Mendelsohn is an honorary senior fellow with the School of Culture and Communication at the University of Melbourne.
I mean, it's nice to see art coming out of the gallery and into the streets and into the courts and winning.
That's Joanna Mendelsohn from the University of Melbourne, Alexandra Humphreys reporting. Well, on programs including this one, you'll often hear scientists trying to explain complex concepts in plain English, but that's a tough task even for the most knowledgeable researchers. Now, 12 of Australia's brightest early career minds have been putting their skills to the test for what's called the FameLab competition in Perth, and they've ditched the PowerPoint slides for something a bit more fun. Isabel Massali prepared this report.
If the thought of public speaking stresses you out, put yourself in the shoes of a young scientist about to take the stage.
Do you know what is even scarier than doing a PhD? Convincing yourself as a young PhD or young scientist to get kitted up with these Britney Spears-style headset microphones. You'll see them in a minute. They're terrifying. And coming up and explaining that research in 3 minutes. And you're doing it in a way that the general audience has to understand.
That's Dr. Kelsey Poole, the MC for this year's National FameLab Final. It's part of the largest science communication competition in the world, and it's open to early career STEM researchers from universities and industry. The rules? Just no slides and no boring.
All right. Our next finalist is Penelope Galbraith with her presentation, Field to Fork, Farm to Gut, Raw Plant Foods and the Bugs in Your Butt.
She's from the CSIRO, and at one point she throws spinach in the air as she explains her investigation into food safety risks in fresh produce.
If disease-causing microbes like salmonella contaminate spinach and you eat it, oh, that salmonella can survive digestion, grow in your gut, and ultimately cause explosive misfortune. But what happens to the billions of other microbes we eat? Could entire microbiomes be transferred from the environment onto food plants and then into your gut microbiome? It was time to put this mystery under the microscope. So I put on my lab coat and began my quest.
Using prompts, body language, enthusiasm, and a bit of acting skills, these researchers explain the problem they're trying to fix and how they're doing it. While some topics naturally lend themselves to storytelling with prompts, the winner, Johannes Diebler, got a bit more creative. He's a research assistant and PhD student at Curtin University, looking at fungal diseases of plants to figure out how they work on a DNA level. He brings out a giant cardboard plant and a Wild West-style wanted poster with a cartoon of an evil mushroom, and then more mushrooms. And the kind of puppet show begins.
So just like keeping burglars from breaking into our houses, we're trying to prevent the fungus from breaking into our crops.
He says he spent months trying to take away the jargon, but without making it dumb.
It's different. It's very different. As I said, I'm used to speaking to a room full of scientists and nerds in the field, but then standing in front of an audience that needs to be convinced that the thing I do is actually worth doing without overloading them with scientific terms. It's challenging, but it's very rewarding in the end, especially when the jokes land.
And for this part, he even brought out comical sunglasses for the fake plant and himself.
Behind every healthy plant is a team of farmers and researchers working hard to keep them safe. Because the only fungi you guys should be worried about at dinner are true fungi like us.
But it's not just about getting 3 minutes in the spotlight. Free training is offered as part of the entry process, and the 12 finalists get more intensive classes. Coralie Bishop is the CEO of the Foundation for the WA Museum, which runs the Australian Final in Perth.
I think it's really important the work that scientists are doing. They're facing and helping answer some of the biggest questions we're facing at the moment in the world. We feel that the more that scientists have the opportunity to talk about the work they're doing, the better for us as a community and as a society.
Kaiwen Beaton describes the training and competition as valuable experience that's transformed her career. She's a neuroscientist studying concussion and one of last year's finalists.
This part that everyone sees is probably the smallest part of all of FameLab.
How daunting is it?
So daunting. It's terrifying. You've got like stage lights in your face. You know you're being live streamed. 3 minutes as well is like, it's so quick, but it's terrifying.
But facing that fear is part of the journey too. The International FameLab final will be held online in late November.
Isabel Massali reporting from Perth. Tomorrow's AFL Grand Final could be the most watched in history, with teams from New South Wales and Queensland meeting in the decider for the first time. Thousands of fans proudly wearing the colours of the Sydney Swans and Brisbane Lions have revelled in the Grand Final parade celebrations in Melbourne today. But even though the teams are now based outside Victoria, some diehard fans remain nostalgic for the two Melbourne clubs that were forced to move north. David Escort prepared this report.
When he was a kid, Darren watched his beloved Fitzroy Lions get thrashed by the South Melbourne Swans. Since then, the two clubs have relocated to Brisbane and Sydney, and he's hoping tomorrow's grand final is the Lions' chance for payback.
Since I was a kid, I was a Fitzroy supporter, and I went to the Lakeside Oval and saw us get flogged by Sydney when I was about four, and now it's time for revenge.
It's a formative experience.
It was indeed.
He's one of thousands who flooded Melbourne's sporting precinct for the grand final parade today, to wish his team well ahead of the blockbuster clash. He's also thrilled to have two teams from outside Victoria battling it out at the MCG.
It's great. The two teams are both chucked out of Victoria. They both get ignored by the metropolitan media. And I can't be happier that it's, Fitzroy and South Melbourne sticking it up.
It's a theme that's resonating with fans this matchup. Two teams born in Melbourne but since exported. South Melbourne moved to Sydney in 1982 and Fitzroy merged with the Brisbane Bears at the end of the 1996 season. Both clubs have built new communities in their adoptive cities. Darren is an old Fitzroy fan and he and his partner Jen travelled up to Brisbane this season to watch the Lions play at the Gabba. They say maintaining a connection to the Lions from here in Melbourne can sometimes be a bit of a challenge.
We've gone up. You went up this year, didn't we?
Yeah, we went up for a game. Yeah, which was a really great experience to try to go up to Brisbane and feel what it was like to feel the buzz up there, because you feel a bit disconnected to them.
Darren wasn't nervous about the game until this morning when it dawned on him. The Lions have got a shot at winning tomorrow.
I wasn't until this morning. This morning I'm pretty nervous. Up until this morning I just assumed we were going to lose, but I've thought we were going to lose ever since we played the Giants. And now I'm beginning to think we might be able to take these guys.
Melbourne man David still thinks of the Lions as partially inspired by his old club in the inner north. He's nostalgic for the days when Fitzroy had their own team.
It's tough, yeah, don't get me wrong. It took a while. After they started winning some premierships, I sort of kept going with it. So, yeah, I've watched some few replays and it's still a bit upsetting. There's still that Fitzroy element to it, which I can't let go of. I still feel like Fitzroy is part of me and I still follow them as part of them.
For 8-year-old Evie, who lives in Melbourne, the Brisbane Lions have never been any other way. As for the team, it's played better and better as the season has gone on. Evie is hoping the strong form they've shown recently will bring them home.
Well, at the start it was okay, but then they actually got better.
And what are you hoping for tomorrow?
For them to win the grand final like they did with the game before the Cats, how they just got a million goals in the last 10 minutes or so.
Lockie Neal is from regional South Australia, captaining a team from Brisbane that was born in Fitzroy in Melbourne's inner city. In a way, it shows the nature of modern AFL, a national game.
It's been an unbelievable ride and we obviously couldn't be here without you guys, both from Brisbane and our members in Victoria and the Fitzroy faithful as well.
Swans captain Dane Rampey also paid tribute to the team's roots in South Melbourne.
Very humbling. Thank you to everyone who's come out, our South Melbourne faithful and those that have travelled to the city. We're so grateful.
If Dane Rampey wasn't showing nerves, Swans fan Berenice Keane was making up for it. She spent 70-odd years backing the Bloods and flew over from Adelaide to watch the match in Melbourne, her hometown.
I'm nervous every match.
That's Sydney Swans fan Berenice Keane. Let's hope it's a great match. Thanks for joining me for PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. I hope you have a great weekend. Good night.
ABC News with Glenn Lauder. Jim Chalmers has wrapped up the first visit by an Australian treasurer to China in 7 years. East Asia correspondent Kathleen Calderwood has more from Beijing.
The treasurer spent a whirlwind trip to China, meeting with economic officials and seeking to better understand what's been happening in its flagging economy and how that might impact Australia. Jim Chalmers said the Chinese delegation sought more information about Australia's foreign investment regulations, which have affected several Chinese investments.
Where a proposal is rejected, it hasn't all been from one country, it hasn't all been from here.
Mr Chalmers said he'd committed to providing his counterparts with more clarity on the regulations in the future. Kathleen Calderwood, ABC News, Beijing.
The importance of the United Nations main aid agency for Palestinians in Gaza has been highlighted at high-level meetings in New York. The UN says Israel's been seeking to discredit the organisation and its work through systematic disinformation campaigns. Jordan's Deputy Prime Minister and Minister of Foreign Affairs, Ayman Safadi, says UNRWA cannot be replaced in Gaza.
The indispensability of UNRWA cannot be questioned, nor can the fact that UNRWA cannot be replaced. For doing that is questioning the right of Palestinian children to food, to shelter, to education and to hope.
A Senate inquiry into last year's major Optus outage has found mobile phone providers should be required to provide fair compensation in the event of another event. With the story, Isabel Rowe.
10 million Optus customers lost coverage for about 12 hours on the 8th of